You know, I'm a former journalist, you know, sort of semi-retired journalist, and I started getting work opportunities in Toronto. Mm-hmm. It was after I started writing for New York-based hip-hop magazines, like mm-hmm. The Source magazine. People are like, hey, this guy knows something about hip-hop culture and youth culture and pop culture, having conquered some parts of the U.S.
Welcome to this week's episode of Black Tea.
I'm Andre Demise.
I'm Milena Williams.
If you're new here, this podcast is where we get into the uncomfortable but necessary conversations in Canada's Black communities. So we'll talk about what made us happy this week, then we'll get to the subject matter, and then we spill a little bit of tea.
But before we get into that, to get us started this week, we have our guest, Dalton Higgins, joining us for our happy segment. Hi.
Howdy.
Milena said that something made her happy this week, but I feel like it's about to make me very uncomfortable. So what you got?
It's really funny. So I was like thinking about how we met and just like know each other, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And do you remember when I ran into you at the AGO last year?
At the Jungle concert.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
So my friend that I was with was like, when she met you, she's like, that's Andre. I'm like, yeah. And she's like, so are you sure nothing has ever happened between you two? And I was like, ew, no. But like, she believed me when she hadn't met you. And I was like, why would you feel that way? And she's like, she didn't even call you good looking. She called you daddy. And I was so upset. It made me physically sick. I'm so sorry.
She called me daddy?
Yeah. And she didn't believe me. And then I was like,
this is why, you know, certain words that we use in a sexual sense, you have to like wall them off from words that we use.
I take daddy seriously. Do not do that.
No, but the thing is, I'm an actual father now.
Oh.
So I'm going to hear the word daddy very differently. Thank you very much.
Ew.
Introducing this awkwardness to my life.
So, well, no, I was just like, should I call him and ask him if I'm sure? She was convincing me, like, what?
Oh, okay.
No.
So your friend, I said, what's up?
We don't like her anymore.
Oh, you don't? Oh, okay.
Yeah, she's done, but.
Oh, word.
Shout out to her.
I feel bad now.
It's fine.
Did her?
You had nothing to do with you.
Oh, I was going to say, I didn't introduce that discord into your friendship, did I?
Maybe because I didn't give you to her, she was mad.
I mean, I'm not single anymore, but I really wish she had served me up to your friends back then, but it's okay.
Oh my
it's all
God,
good.
You're so thirst.
I'm glad that made you happy. It made me a little bit happy, but also a bit awkward.
Okay, good. Hi, Dalton.
Hey, Mel.
What made you happy this week?
What made me happy this week? Okay, well, this happened last week, but it sort of bleeds into this week, or it's actually timeless. You know the hashtag ball is life? Well, it is life. Mm-hmm. I'm like a former baller. I went to this school in Toronto called Oakwood Collegiate, Go Barons.
Oh, okay.
Winner of multiple city championships. So my happy moment this week, it's basketball related. It's ex-Raptors coach Dwayne Casey returning.
I don't like where this is going.
I mean, so if you believe in redemption, you know, karma, hubris, kismet.
I don't believe in any of those things, as a matter of fact.
Then you will appreciate this Dwayne Casey story. I mean, he, mm-hmm. you know, he gets, he wins NBA Coach of the Year.
Yes.
You know, coaching Toronto Raptors, best record in the regular season in the franchise's history. Does all the things a good coach is supposed to do.
Right.
And gets run out of town. Got fired. And then found some gainful employment coaching the Detroit Pistons. Returns back to Toronto to play his ex-Toronto Raptors franchise that ran him out of town, and they defeat the Toronto Raptors.
That is some bad
shit.
I like
straight
that.
Fired. He just got straight fired.
Okay.
Yeah, so that's my happy moment, you know, if you believe in, yeah, tales of redemption.
That's
and
great.
You know, so I have such a good feeling.
Him Dalton, coming. I'm going to need you to get the out of my studio.
Why are you
get
mad?
Because I'm a Raptors fan. And listen, I like Dwayne Casey. I like DeMar DeRozan. I haven't lost any love for them since, as Dalton would say, we're run out of town. I haven't lost any love for them whatsoever, but I want my team to win. So
right.
I'm glad you find it so great that he started our losing streak. Thank you.
Well, here's the thing. I mean, when you look at culture too, I mean, Dwayne Casey is one of, you know, there are not nearly enough sort of, you know, Black African-American head coaches in the NBA.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking to myself, looking at it through a sort of culture prism, you know, what more else did the guy need to do? You know, he led the Raptors to the best record in the franchise's history, won NBA Coach of the Year, and then gets fired. You know, so that's just looking at it from a diversity
swept out the playoffs
that's
again.
Dope.
Right, sure. I mean, if we dig a little deeper,
again.
You know,
Right. It didn't happen just once.
Well, you need a winning team.
There's no convincing these Raptor junkies, Raptor groupies, Raptor, you know,
like
season ticket holders that are sitting
in. Would you like to host the show? I can leave. It's okay. Okay.
Okay, Andre.
I'm glad that made you so happy. We'll move on to my segment. This conversation did not make me happy. I'll tell you that. So Jill Scott, Madam Jill Scott, the light of my life, the artist to whom so many of today's millennials were conceived, who also plays like an awesome bad character on the TV show Black Lightning. Somebody, and this wasn't a recent concert, but somebody pulled up a concert that Jill Scott did. And during her performance, let's call it rather animated.
You have to see it though.
You actually have to look at this. Like as Jill is performing, she's like caressing the microphone in a very suggestive way. And then it goes from just caressing the microphone. Okay, I'm just going to come out and say it. She was basically like, it looked like she was performing oral sex. On nothing, but the thing is like, there was no guy there. There's no like performer that she could simulate it with. She was simulating sex with a microphone, but her technique was on point.
Maybe that's the future. We don't even need men to do it. I'm down with that.
Okay, Miss Jill, thank you very much for that. I needed that in my life. When I say things like, we're living in a hellscape, I'm usually joking about that. But where it comes to Toronto's art scene, I am not kidding about that at all. The best and brightest of our artists who spend years producing groundbreaking work in the 90s and 2000s, well, they're mostly forgotten. And the ground that they broke, sonically, visually, and with the written word, mostly got paved over with gentrified Canadian mediocrity. At least, that's my opinion. But maybe I'm wrong on this. Maybe there is some hope for the future. So joining us today to guide us through the modern artistic landscape in Canada's Black communities, we've got author, publicist, and unofficial Canadian hip-hop chronicler, Dalton Higgins. Dalton, welcome to the show.
Hey, how's it going?
Pretty good. Man, where do you even like start in the conversation on art in Canada's Black communities? Because it feels pretty bleak right now. What do you think?
Yeah. What I would say is we're a bit, delusional in Canada in general, Toronto in particular, where I'm based, in that we spend an awful lot of time patting ourselves on the back for being multicultural. And we know that, statistically speaking, Toronto is the most multicultural city on the planet. That diversity is not at all reflected across like different sectors, right? So we're talking about, let's talk about literary arts, for example. Yeah. You know, I've written 6 books, so I know of what I speaketh. You know, I've kind of been around the block. How you just introed this segment, it just brought me back to when I was working at the Harbourfront Centre, which is considered, Canada's Centre of Contemporary Culture. And they run something called the International Festival of Authors. And I just remember working there years ago. And this is at a time when I cranked out a best-selling book. It's called Hip Hop World. And it's a book that talks about hip-hop, youth culture, globalization. And, people over there booking it, so I'm on the, I got the cover of the Toronto Star, which is Canada's largest daily newspaper. And they didn't even call me to do anything. You can moderate a panel discussion, you can do a session, you can do a reading. So while I'm there, I'm on the cover of Toronto Star, right? And there's a literary festival that's supposed to be representing the interest of Canada's literary communities, and nothing, I didn't get called. And so that was sort of my wake-up call.
That is not
much like Dwayne Casey, ex-Raptors coach.
We don't show love.
NBA coach of the year. And,
we don't show love.
Yeah.
No, we don't show love. Well, I just happen to be
Black and African descent. If you're going to keep talking about Dwayne Casey in this manner.
So if you look at things, meritocracy, you're selling books, because this is what we're in the industry to do, is to push products, sell books.
Right.
And one is somehow thinking that is going to generate more interest and opportunities on the Canadian literary landscape, you're in for a surprise,
I mean, we just have so much, obviously, so much raw talent in this city. What do you feel like people don't know about that?
Yeah. I mean, I sat on this racial equity advisory committee with the Canada Council for the Arts. And what we were tasked with doing was doing a scan of the Canadian art scene, multidisciplinary arts, meaning, theater, drama, literary arts, dance, music, et cetera, et cetera. And what we found, it was chilling. It was chilling in that. Here's the conundrum. In Canada, when you're looking, there's a saying we say, if you see it, you can be it. Growing up here, if you're from a racialized community, young, Black boy, girl, and you want to be, a producer, in dance, you want to be an editor. Black producers, they're scant to non-existent, right? So what you're forced to do, like myself, is seek inspiration and mentorship elsewhere, So when I started out in the game as a journalist, like all of my mentors, people whose works, you know, who I can call at a, you know, moment's notice to get some mentorship, advice, tips on how to navigate the literary marketplace, they're not here.
Yeah.
Right? They're in Harlem, New York. They're in Los Angeles, California, Oakland, California, you know?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So this is, that concerns me.
But that richness, you brought it back. A lot of people don't come back.
Right.
They leave. So, I mean, I just feel like, yeah, but you've connected so many people and like, this is, I guess, kind of what you do, right? Among the many things you do.
Yeah, yeah.
Kind of infusing that global lens that you have.
Yeah. I mean, I think I do it out of both choice and necessity. Right. Yeah. So the easy thing is to get the hell out of Dodge. You know, that's what most Canadian success stories
that look like me. I hate that. Why do our artists have to leave this country in order to make a fortune and then come back and be celebrated? Why can't we celebrate them here?
Right. Yeah. For one, it's a Canadian thing, you know, in general, as far as the macro is most Canadian artists. You look at comedian Russell Peters, like he's nowhere to be seen. He's out in LA doing, you know, you get out of Dodge. So it's a uniquely Canadian thing.
But don't forget that Russell Peters also said that, you know, he didn't really feel welcome here in Canada. Like he grew up in Brampton, which is like the brownest community in this country.
Right.
And he still felt like he was not welcome here. But he goes to the United States and he feels welcome as an American.
That happens to all of us. Like, we have this, like, hater. Like, we almost convince ourselves that we're haters, and then we keep hating.
Yeah, yeah. No, totally.
That?
I mean, here's a funny story. Like, in one of the... I wrote a book about Drake, you know what I mean? Like, it's called Far From Over, the Music and Life of Drake, and it's a biography of his life. And in the story, like, there's some really weird things that happened, some of which you know. Like, you know, the Juno Awards a number of years ago. Like, he hosts the Juno Awards. And this is just an anecdote, just to drive home the point. So... You know, at the time, he hosted Juno Awards, the 40th edition of the Juno Awards, and he got nominated for 6 awards. And in the United States, he's the biggest thing since sliced bread, right? So he's dominating the playlist, the charts in the United States, right? Which is like the epicenter of, you know, so-called urban music, right?
Right.
And so he hosts the Juno Awards and gets nominated 6 times, doesn't win 1 award. While he's being celebrated elsewhere, while he's like the biggest artist in the United States, you know what I mean? And elsewhere, right?
Yeah.
So this is kind of like, these are the types of horror stories that I can, you know, regale you with. Right? And this is the reason Drake is never going to come. He's never going to come back to the Juno Awards. You know what I mean?
Maybe that's also
what reliable
why
sources tell
so
me.
Sad.
He is not ever coming back to the Juno Awards.
Like he was that slighted by it.
100%.
Well, yeah, I would be too.
Anybody would be.
I would be living.
Yeah.
I mean, we joke about that, but I think about, you know, how other Canadian artists who don't have the amount of wealth and prestige that Drake has, how it feels for them when they end up getting slighted by their own country. I think about somebody like the writer Nalo Hopkinson, who you might remember wrote the book Brown Girl in the Ring, which was my introduction to Afrofuturism. Like, I wasn't the Octavia Butler generation. This was like, for me, it was a brand new thing. And Nalo Hopkinson, after she wrote the book, experienced poverty on a level that a best-selling author should never have to experience. She was actually homeless for a time. She had some health issues. And then, you know, when her health deteriorated, her employability went down. And she, like, having written so many great books, was homeless.
Right.
And now she's, I think, okay. She's back on her feet. She was hired by University of California, Riverside. So she's an assistant professor there.
She left.
She had to leave Canada to live.
Well, we see that in Nalo Hopkinson. Yeah, she's a national treasure.
Yeah.
I mean, she's just one of the leading, as far as
she
sci-fi.
She should be a national treasure, but we don't treasure her.
No, we do not treasure her. So, and the key thing you said there is she got offered a gig at University of California, Riverside. Like, not here. Not University of Toronto, not York University. One would think that they'd be, headhunting, want to scoop her up immediately.
You would think that York or even like Dalhousie, you know, which has like a large contingent of black students, you would think that they would want to put her in front of potential writers.
I read her in a course at York. Reading that book was our reading. So she was obviously well respected in academia. Mm-hmm. And just to see a black woman get treated like that is devastating.
Our narrative as creatives, as far as journalism, you know, I'm a former journalist, you know, sort of semi-retired journalist, and that's my narrative though, right? I started getting work opportunities in Toronto. Mm-hmm. It was after I started writing for New York-based hip-hop magazines, like The Source magazine, which was at one time considered, you know, the Bible of hip-hop culture.
It was, yeah.
And Vibe magazine, right? Yeah, that's when I started getting work back here.
Yeah, yeah.
Is when I was writing for American magazines, you know what I mean? And then people are like, hey, this guy knows a little bit of something about hip-hop culture and youth culture and pop culture.
Yeah.
Right?
And that's already did.
Yeah, I already did. But here, you know, is locally, it wasn't, celebrated,
rewarded.
They won't
recognize your bona fides until it's acknowledged by the Americans first.
Precisely, yeah. That's when the work opportunity started going through the roof in Toronto.
Right.
Is after having conquered some parts of the U.S.
Wow.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about just your career and your writing. And you just take so seriously history and like our history and emphasizing it in your work. Why has that been important for you to locate and use that lens?
I mean, I have this, you know, love affair with black music and people, obviously, you know, and I think, you know, we talk about the predominant, the music forms that are essentially dominating the playlists, especially now. We're talking about Afro-diasporic musics, right? Mm-hmm. Certainly led by hip-hop, R&B. And that's no longer arguable or open to debate. When you look at the top-selling musics in Canada and the U.S., it's there's nothing to dispute,
where
right? Look
they,
at the SoundScans Award. It's they say the numbers now are between 33% to 35% of all music consumed, hip hop and R&B.
Finally,
right? Yeah. So more than 1/3 of all music's consumed, our music. Yeah. Now, one of the issues I have as far as chronicling our culture, being a documentarian of our culture, is that a lot of the people that are telling the stories of our culture, of our music, of our people, they don't look like us.
Yeah.
You know.
Mm-hmm.
So a lot of the chroniclers of black music, sadly and unfortunately, are non-black. So I have this kind of thing where, I'm living it, I'm breathing it.
Right.
My father used to come home, after work and, crank reggae music, I was born here, my parents came here from Jamaica in the late 60s. I just know a ton more about reggae music, soul music, R&B, hip-hop.
And you can't teach
than
that.
Than your average,
than
your average non-black cultural critic that dabbles in black music and an ethnomusicologist.
Right.
Okay, so that's part of what it is, my love affair with black music and black people and the music that we create.
If we're going to use a historical lens, I mean, we're not even going back that far in history to talk about artists from the 90s, early 2000s and so forth. So I notice a difference between the way that Toronto bigs up its own artists and the way that a city like Atlanta does the same thing. So I can't go back and locate the sounds of a Drake or Tory Lanez. I can't locate that in Mishimi or Devon or Maestro Fresh West or any of them. It seems like every generation of artists that comes out of Toronto has to basically start over from scratch. But then in Atlanta, you have that influence from the Dungeon family. So you know about the Dungeon family, right? Outkast is part of them.
Frank Goody Mob.
Yeah, exactly. Goody Mob. And then the producers that came out of that. So Sleepy Brown basically had an influence over so many artists that came out of Atlanta. And then that family, that group of associated acts influenced people like Migos, influenced Future, influenced Zaytoven. There's an A to B to C connection between the artists that they produced in the 90s and 2000s to who we see as popular today. Toronto doesn't have that. Why that disconnect?
Right. Yeah. I mean, I think if you don't, part of the reason I am a bit of a, a lot of a documentarian as far as a local Black Canadian music is for that reason, we have to better document and then share, of course. I wrote, my first book was a book, Master T, for people that grew up on Much Music,
Yeah.
So, he was he was actually the leading VJ at Much Music for a number of years. So, when Madonna is in town wanting to do that, intimate one-on-one, he's conducting the interview.
Mm-hmm.
Lenny Kravitz, Janet Jackson, J-Lo, it goes on and on. Britney Spears, whatever music genre you're into, he's the guy doing those intimate one-on-ones.
He was the first man I saw on TV that they let in front of a camera with his long dreads.
Absolutely.
Yeah, it wasn't till him.
Oh, for sure. No, he was black and proud, proud and black.
Oh, yeah.
And he had locks and everything, right? He was not watering down anything that he did. You know what I mean? Very proud of his culture and roots. And the funny thing is, so in that book, so part of my responsibility, as a documentarian is to sort of document those histories and then disseminate that info to the new gen, to millennials, to the average 19-year-old. So they understand sort of what came before them, right?
Yeah.
We did this interesting project at the end of 2017 where I basically, there's a house in Parkdale in Toronto owned by this organization called BAND, Black Artist Network in Dialogue.
Mm-hmm. Uh-huh. Yeah.
And what we did is to commemorate, hip-hop history in Toronto, I threw a bunch of OGs, you know what I mean? I threw Mishy Me was there. Right? Ghetto Concept.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
A group from Rexdale that had won, back-to-back Juno Awards back in the day.
Big up and salutations, Rexdale.
Yeah, Rexdale, exactly.
Yeah, that's my neighborhood.
Yeah, we threw him in a room with, Claremont II, who's this fantastic, he's 21 years old.
Yeah.
Amazing. Oh my God, I went to that party.
Yeah,
in the house, great. Yeah,
so all of these, 19, 21-year-old rappers and,
Wasn't
40-somethings. Cardinal Official was there, all right? The Canadian ambassador, the original. Cardinal is an interesting character because he was celebrating being a Torontonian and a Canadian rapper before it became cool, sexy, or saleable.
And he keeps doing it. He's amazing.
Because there was a time when I'm a Toronto rapper, I'm a Canadian rapper. That's frowned upon outside of these borders. He was doing it way before it became. Now it's just cliche. It's just like, okay, the sixes ins, you know, even like Norm Kelly, who I despise.
Good riddance.
You know, like he's like, the six dead and all this crap.
That's ridiculous.
You know, good riddance.
Any opportunity to on Norm Kelly, I will always appreciate that in this studio.
Yeah, totally. Yeah, good riddance. Exactly. Norm Kelly. We're going to have like a Norm Kelly good riddance party. I'm so disgusted.
Speaking of like culture vultures that do damage to the community, what effect does an organization like Spotify, for example, which is a Swedish-based tech organization, what effect do they have on the broader music culture? Like, for example, let's take hip-hop off the table for a second. Have you ever tried to listen to a dancehall playlist on Spotify?
Not so much, mostly hip-hop, R&B, soul, Afrobeats, not so much dancehall.
I don't recommend ever doing that to yourself. It's seriously, like, go look up dancehall on Spotify and see what comes up. And let's take it even past Spotify for a second. Let's talk about the effect gentrifying hip-hop has. And I hate to say this because I don't think it applies to people like, say, DJ starting from scratch, who is incredibly good at what he does. And also, he's a Brampton man's. But the amount of clout that people who are not from the culture, who are not Black themselves, exercise on Black community productions. Like, what effect does that have on sort of distorting what passes for popular in hip-hop culture now? Because, who's, one of the top-selling acts right now and the most influential hip-hop artist? Post Malone.
Yeah. Yes.
Oh, God.
Facts.
What does that do? Like,
right.
What does that do to the culture?
Yeah. As far as starting from scratch, he's an interesting figure in that he's a fantastic DJ. Fantastic DJ.
Listen, I'm taking nothing away from his talents whatsoever.
Yes.
But the fact is, he's not a Black person.
Yeah, for sure. Now, here's the thing. This is where it gets complex and contradictory.
Okay.
Is as far as our own community respecting and studying our own craft, is that happening in the way it should? No, I would say absolutely not.
Mm-hmm.
So what you have here is I can be, sort of a Blacker than thou, young woman, young man that professes to be a DJ, but has not studied the masters that come from our community.
Right.
Mm. So you come out now DJing these haphazard, mediocre DJ sets, call yourself a DJ, of Black music. Then you have somebody Scratch, on the other hand, he's studying the masters. He's a white guy.
But there's another thing about studying Blackness, too, that is a problem that goes beyond
there's
music as well.
There's a difference between studying and surveillance, and I feel like there's a lot of surveillance.
But I also feel like we do a lot of, giving away our culture if people deserve it. Like, this whole cookout, I've never been endorsing that. Like, there is no cookout.
I love inviting people to the cookout. Oh, yeah.
I don't like it.
Oh, yeah. Come on down to the cookout. Get yourself a plate.
Our culture is actually special and beautiful and unique, and you're not invited. And if you're so thirst to be invited, that means that, you have identity issues.
Right. Our culture, it needs to be our music culture in particular, because I'm going to talk, a lot about literary arts and music, but it needs to be preserved. It needs to be studied. It needs to be worshipped.
Yeah.
It needs to be in our own homes.
But it can't be worshipped.
It's not enough to be, we have to actually appreciate and study versus studying European music traditions, right?
But if we're...
If we grew up in these colonized households that are saying, hey, let's go to the opera. Let's go to the Canadian Opera Company, Jamaican family, Guyanese family, and you're not invested in studying mento, ska, reggae, dancehall, right? Because this is what happens here. A lot of our parents have these sort of colonized kind of like, hey, I'm going to take my son to Toronto Symphony Orchestra.
Right.
What about your own culture and history?
And my whole thing is, it's just like, I don't care how much you learn about our culture, you're never going to be able to teach us.
No, I second that notion.
Yeah.
I studied at York University in Toronto, English literature and mass communications. And I remember my fourth year, doing like a thesis on historically Black musics. And my, professor who led, my thesis was, was a white woman. And her tone, the way she sort of, her point of view, her frame of reference, like her entry point to, I don't care how many, PhDs, graduate work she did. It was just radically separate from how I viewed
Culture. Rachel Dolezal cannot give that to you.
No, I'm sorry. You can study gospel music till you're blue in the face.
Yeah.
I grew up some parts, the Black church, although I don't go to church now, but I'm just like, no, I live this.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean? I'm living and breathing this thing. So it's different from some academic, non-Black academic telling me what gospel music was, is, and should be.
Right.
What I wanted to get to in this question was, what sort of an effect does that have? Because to your point about, DJs who don't really study the craft, DJ Premier talks about this all the time. He calls it like, y'all ain't DJs. You're just pushing a bunch of buttons.
Sure.
And I understand that that's a shortcoming from the community, but what effect does it have on the culture where we're basically letting people come in from outside and then dictate how the culture is produced and distributed?
One thing about Black people of African descent, and this is across sectors, you know, whether it be literary, arts, dance, theater, there's something about us. I remember when Roseanne Barr, you know, she was going through, you know, the other day, and she said something real interesting about how she says, not to verbatim, but she said something about Black people were the most forgiving and open-minded. So
yeah,
we let anybody in our house.
Cookout.
You know, yeah, the cookout.
Stop,
you know?
This cookout.
So she made a point of saying that Black people, we're just the most kind-hearted and forgiving and welcoming. And
what
something
the
about
massa
that
is that?
Come on, down, Roseanne.
That run me the wrong way.
Get you a plate.
Right.
Take some of this oxtail to go.
Yes, precisely. Yeah. Whereas other cultures, other, you know, as far as racial designations, ethno-cultural groups, I don't think they're so willing to kind of let you, hey, you can just, you know, be
South Asian
for a day, be, you know, indigenous for a day. Right. I don't think so. I don't think it works like that.
And white supremacy absolutely doesn't work like that either.
It does not. No, it does not. So,
but we're getting...
So it's something we have to look, you know, within our culture. No, and we're, you know, we want to do good, be, you know, good people and with a big heart and open-minded and, you know, open arms. But at some point in time, we have to draw the line, is what I would say,
absolutely.
Right? To avoid the Norm Kellyification of of Black culture, you know? Yeah.
Yeah.
Dalton, thank you so much for joining us. It was wonderful to have you.
Thank you very kindly.
So now we're going to spill the tea this week, and we're doing it together because the tea is really hot.
The other thing is, it kind of pissed us off both equally. So Milena and I will normally try to not have conversations during the week so we can like have a pretty good interplay when we come in to record.
It's really uncomfortable. It's basically ruining our friendship.
It is. this podcast is like breaking us off as friends. But this
one... came together to hate.
Yeah, we really had to both hate on this particular tea topic. So... Mel, you know, it's actually upsetting me too much. Why don't you tell the audience about it?
So Michelle Williams, the third member of Destiny's Child, is engaged to a man named Chad Johnson. They have a new reality show on OWN. And she's sort of been making her way back into the spotlight, I think, probably since she performed at Coachella with Beyonce. Mm-hmm. And, you know, she seems like a great woman. And I've been a fan of Destiny's Child forever, 20 years. So, like, yeah, it's great to see Michelle happy. She was very open about her struggle with depression. And it's great to see her in the public eye. So, obviously, it would be exciting that she's getting married. But it turns out she's marrying a racist Mr. Clean.
Well... So, okay, so Chad Johnson is a pastor, but he's also a chaplain. So he's a guy that will lead athletes in prayer. He's like one of those hip, sort
white
of like,
dude.
Comes across as one of those cool white guys. He's like that hip youth pastor that kind of grew into his own.
People so, want him to look Black. He doesn't look Black to me.
He has a bald head.
Yeah.
He has strong features.
Mm-hmm.
He actually has lips, which is...
Oh, right. He doesn't have thin, villainous lips. Let's get to what he did wrong.
No, he's got full lips, and he has a beard, a red beard. So he is a handsome, adjacent dude.
Mm-hmm.
And and because he's saved and she's saved, I think they kind of found each other.
Yeah.
But the problem is, and this happens often in interracial relationships, which is why this is difficult to talk about, but oftentimes in interracial relationships, having to bring the white partner up to speed in what you're going through on a day-to-day basis is difficult, because even though they love you and even though they appreciate you and they want the best for you and they want to be like the love of your life, they often will not understand how difficult it is to navigate life on a day-to-day basis being Black. And then the worst thing that happens is when you try to explain to them things that are difficult for you, they try to downplay what it is that you go through.
They gaslight you. I can just imagine.
Yeah. I don't think we can even like...
Like, we guys gotta play the clip.
We gotta play
honestly.
The clip and then go through it like piece by piece, because there is so much upness to this clip that I think we have to break it down for the audience.
And this is the scene where they are doing a video chat with their therapist together, which is pretty normal. From the reality show Chad. Is it called Chad? It's ironically called Chad Loves Michelle.
Chad Loves Michelle is what
oh
it's
my
called.
God. Okay, let's go.
How have you all been communicating this week?
Communication this week has been good until last night. We had a disagreement. I said something to him on the lines of, well, Chad, because you are not Black, you would not understand why I communicate the way I do. Maybe because you didn't grow up around a lot of Black people. And so that was very, very offensive to Chad. He talked about a moment of how I said it's because I'm black and you're white and you don't know how black people talk. So he didn't like that.
So this is going to be an important theme for us to talk about the issue of race.
Yeah. Right?
And figuring out what's race and what's individual.
That's
right?
True. Yeah.
Okay. So Chad, tell me what your honest thoughts are.
To me, it doesn't matter if you're black, white, green, yellow. It doesn't matter. If you...
First of all.
Green? Green?
Who is out here getting green?
Anybody? That actually sounds kind of good.
I'm just saying, why when people start talking about, you know, not being able to see color, they gotta start with black and then white, and then go off on some like weird color chromas that do not exist in the human spectrum.
They erase us because they want to seem like they are so racist and implicitly biased that they think by telling us that they don't see that we're black, it's a compliment.
And
you're lying next to this guy.
Yeah, it really isn't. When you say that you do not see my color, and you've said this before, yeah. Mel, you're saying that you don't see me as a human being.
Yeah.
You have to strip my color away from me in order to love me.
And you're talking to Beyonce's friend like that? Please keep going. Let's play the rest of this clip.
Know that the other person was like, I didn't like the way you said that. Then seek to find some understanding as to why that person didn't like what you said. You know, and let's keep that the issue. Not pull in all these other things, because then it feels like you're just trying to cut, you know? And then it feels like you're just trying to push further away.
But this is not to justify, but yesterday when we had the disagreement, he says, did you take your meds today? Now that...
But wait, that was Dr. Tama. I would never go there, and I apologize for...
But you shouldn't go there regardless.
And I don't think you should ever go there with black and white.
Okay,
Oh my God. Okay, listen.
Okay, let me get this thought out.
Okay.
Because I'm trying to keep it clean here. If you are in a relationship with somebody that has mental health issues, if you're in a relationship with somebody, for example, that has depression, like I do, or anxiety, like I do, or other conditions, bipolarity, even things like schizophrenia, or never, ever, ever in your life pull that card out to say, did you take your meds today?
It is so manipulative.
When somebody has a problem with you, then you work through that problem verbally. You do not then pull their mental health issue out to say, well, this is not to do with you disagreeing with me or you having a problem that we need to resolve. This is just your mental health issues acting up right now. That is so f***ed up to do that.
Yeah. And it was that moment I really had a problem with the fact that instead of being accountable for his actions, he was so defensive about the race thing that he basically turned into like white women tears. And he referred to the therapist and was like, I wasn't trying to, it wasn't even important for him to tell his partner that he didn't want to hurt her. He needed to tell the therapist that wasn't his intent. And this is what people always do. I didn't mean to be racist. And it's just like, you can't even be in a relationship. You can't be in a relationship like that. You cannot be doing that.
You saw the other thing that he did too, right? He's like, well, you know, I shouldn't bring up the mental health thing, or I shouldn't bring up the depression.
But you shouldn't
thing.
Bring up.
But you shouldn't bring up the black. Do you see what he just did? So these are both issues that have to do with her. She's black. She has depression. But do you see how he's like, well, if I can't bring up your depression, you can't bring up the black thing.
And this is what he's doing on camera.
Bro, what the f*** is wrong with you? All right, continue.
And it was after she said again, and then I got mad and I was like, did you take your meds today? She knows how to cut.
He's calling her an angry black woman by saying she knows how to cut. And he's using his skills as a speaker and a pastor to like make badly reasoned points and sound reasonable because he's white.
Right. So she knows how to cut, apparently, but he knows how to cut up in front of the camera.
Oh my God.
And I don't want to make this a black woman thing because I think this exists in a lot of interracial relationships, which is where...
The specific disempowering and like power dynamic of like... an argument and getting a race like that is specific to black women. And it happens to us not just by our romantic partners and not just by white people. Mm. It happens with, so it's just like, and this is an intimate relationship and you guys are choosing to show this on television. And this is what he's choosing to do in the first episode. What?
I'm going to put this. When people are looking for partners, especially black people who are like in the late 20s to early 30s and really starting to looking for that person to settle down with. I've seen a trend, and maybe this doesn't translate to broader society, but I've seen a trend where people say that, you know, it's hard for me to be with a black person because, you know, they have their
Black people are saying that about
Yeah, black people say that about other black people. Like, black men...
Really?
Yeah, like, I've seen black women say this, that, you know, black men have their trauma and the things that they grew up with and their struggles. Why am I going to add their trauma and their struggles to my trauma and my struggles?
I've seen black men say it,
and I've seen black men say,
to date white women.
No, I've seen the same... I've seen black men say the same thing. And I've also seen black men talk about, well, the angry black woman stereotype has a grain of truth to it.
Yeah, whatever.
And it's like, so what you're basically saying is, because you have not been able to deal with what racism has done to you, you externalize it by projecting it on the rest of the community.
Yeah.
That is messed up. So you go and you look for somebody that you feel is like a racial blank slate.
Oh my God. Nobody is a blank slate. Everybody has contacts.
But I see this happen, that black people will seek interracial relationships with a white person, and there's nothing wrong with doing that. But the motive behind it is like, well, you know, they don't have to deal with race stuff, so it's going to be okay.
And why is identity stuff? Like, I just feel like when people are doing this kind of like, because Tamara Mowry does this all the time, and so do all her hosts of The Real, they all have to defend her husband routinely for just literally being racist. And it's just like, if your relationship is so great and you've erased race and you guys are so happy, then why are you so stupid? Chad. No, honestly.
I think that's where we're going to have to leave it for this week.
Thank you so much for listening. Shout out to Frequency Network for having us and our sister podcasts.
Thanks very much to our show producer, Ryan Clark.
And to our music producer, Black Orchid.
You can find me on Twitter at Andre Demise.
You can find me at Melina Williams. And you can find our guest at Dalton Higgins 5.
You can listen to the show on the frequencypodcastnetwork.com or on Apple and Google Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, Overcast, or wherever you get your podcasts. And if you like the show, please support us by heading over to iTunes, leaving us that 5-star rating. And if you're feeling extra generous, tell us what you think about the show.
We'll see you next week.
Bye.